Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, the pound slumped to its lowest level in over a year this week as UK borrowing costs soared to the highest peak for more than a quarter of a century. Just what is going on out there? What's gone wrong with the economy? Is it Truss mini budget disaster Mark II? What does it mean for interest rates? And importantly, for our money. Also today, the US hedge fund trying to raid seven investment trusts. Private shareholders are being urged to vote. What is happening and why does it even matter? January the 10th is Quitter's Day, apparently. So if you're looking for a new job paying just a little bit more cash, we have those that saw the biggest pay rise last year. And friend of This Is Money, Dave Bank of Dave Fishwick, has a new film out. So Lee turns entertainment reporter and caught up with him to get the inside goss. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the cost of borrowing soared to its highest level for more than a quarter of a century this week as gilt yields continued to rise. Just months after the budget, the yield on 30-year gilts reached more than 5.25% earlier in the week, for the first time since 1998, and they continued to tick up after that. Meanwhile, the yield on a 10-year gilt is up to 4.8%, the highest level since the financial crisis. Now, it all sounds rather big, but what does it actually mean? What are gilts? Why are they rising? And what does it mean for the UK economy and for households? Simon Lee, welcome to the show. Simon, an economics 101. Before we start going into what all of this means and stuff, what are gilts? What are gilt yields? You've got a great article on your website, by the way, about this. Explains it beautifully. So explain it for us.
Gilts are UK government bonds. So the government issues bonds and investors buy them. And in return for lending the government money, investors are paid interest, which is known as a coupon on a bond. So basically, for example, the government wants to raise £1,000. It normally wants to raise more than £1,000. So I'll let you into a little secret there. But say the government wants to raise £1,000. The government issues a bond for £1,000, and it does that over a certain duration. So it could do it over 1 year, could do it over 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, could even do it over 30 years. And in return for lending the government that money, the investor who buys the bond gets paid an interest rate return, which is known as the coupon, as I said, over that period of time. So say, for example, they get paid 5%. That means that every year they will get paid 5% of the face value of the bond, so the £1,000, so they'll be getting £50. At the end of the term, they get all of their money back. The government issues large amounts of bonds every single year because we spend more than we raise in tax. Basically, this is what helps to fund, you know, the deficit that we have. Also, bonds can be used as well for longer term things. So, for example, you might want to raise money for investment in the economy. It isn't just covering day-to-day spending that you can't afford. In the same way that, you know, it's perfectly sensible to take out a mortgage to buy a home, it's also perfectly sensible to borrow for the long term in order to invest that money because you think you can speculate to accumulate and you'll get more back from investing in it, from improving infrastructure and things like that. Now, the interest rate return that you get on a bond, as I said, the interest is referred to as a coupon. The interest rate return is referred to as the yield. The yield basically measures the income you're getting versus the face value of the bond. And all of those bonds, when they're issued, will pay a set amount, and that is decided at issuance. And there's an auction that goes on where basically there's a bit of to-ing and fro-ing. The government wants to raise a certain amount of money. How much are investors willing to pay in? How much do they want to buy? If there's lots of demand for it, it pushes that yield down and they can get away with issuing that debt at a lower yield. If there's less demand for it, then they realize actually we're going to need to offer people a better return on this so that the yield bumps up. But once that's set and they get the auction out the way, the yields on those bonds is set. People buy those bonds, right? You can buy bonds secondhand on the market, and that's where you start to get yields moving around. Because, for example, if you wanted to buy one of the bonds that was issued during the aftermath of the financial crisis, for example, when interest rates are very, very low, you might find that you've got a UK government bond that's only paying 2%. Well, you're not going to want to pay face value for that now, because you could stick your money in a savings account and get 5%. Even if you are a big institutional investor, can't stick their money in a savings account. But, the Bank of England base rate is a lot higher than 2% these days. So, in order for people to buy those bonds secondhand on the market, they want a discount. So, they're not going to pay, what the face value of those bonds is. So, they might pay less than that. And that means that the yield kind of moves around. So, basically, it's a measure of the cost of borrowing. Now, what happens is those kind of movements in the secondary market and the auctions that go on, the price that people are willing to pay for the bonds that are being issued that offer X percent return, deliver this measurement of a gilt yield. And if gilt yields are going up, that means that bond prices are going down because the yield moves in the opposite direction to prices, as I just explained. And it means that the cost of government borrowing is rising. The problem with the cost of government borrowing rising is that borrowing more money gets more expensive. You're having to pay investors more money in order for them to be willing to lend you money. But also, the cost of servicing your debt gets more expensive if you've got a particularly big debt pile and so on. So, at the moment, what we have is a situation where, as you said at the start of the show, gilt yields are on the rise. But that's the basic explanation of gilts. And actually, the other thing to say about gilts is gilts are considered to be one of the best government bond investments that you can get in the world. In terms of bonds, right, you get government bonds, you get corporate bonds, which are issued by companies, and government bonds are seen as the safest. And the safest of those are, right at the top tier of government bonds, are seen as the ones that are the least likely to default. So the ones that are most likely to keep paying you the interest that you're due to be paid and to give you your money back at the end. You've got US Treasuries, UK gilts, German bunds are pretty much the top tier of all of that. US Treasuries are usually the one at the top because the global financial system is totally dominated by the dollar. Germans are seen as super financially cautious, very, very safe, definitely going to get your money back. German economy isn't doing too well at the moment either. So, and UK gilts, obviously, we're seen as a pretty stable economy. And even with all of the ructions that we have seen over recent years and since the financial crisis, we've pretty much maintained that top tier status all the way through. And the other great advantage of the US and the UK is that we are highly, highly, highly unlikely ever to default on our debt because we control our own currency via our central bank and we can print the money. We could basically print the money to pay people if we need to. You can only get away with that game for so long before people stop lending you money because obviously the more money that you print, the more you're devaluing the currency. And so it's not just whether you're going to default, it's what the value of that money that you're getting back is worth. So, say, for example, you lend the UK £1,000 now and you're going to get your money back in 10 years. What's that £1,000 going to be worth in 10 years? If we manage to keep a lid on inflation and run a tight ship, your £1,000 in 10 years is going to be pretty good. If we manage to let inflation run amok, and keep a very, very loose hand on the economic tiller, then that £1,000 in 10 years' time is going to be worth beans.
Right. So, with that in mind, the risk here with gilts is less about how you would expect with company bonds. So, if you think the company's going to go under, then you'd want a bit more back before you start lending the money. But here, it seems to be influenced heavily by interest rates and inflation. Is that the risk we're talking about here? And therefore, that feeds into what is going on at the minute.
Okay, so but no country operates in isolation, for a start. So, but imagine a country did operate in isolation. If a country operated in isolation, investors would be looking at those crucial things. Am I going to get my money back? Am I going to get paid my coupon? And, am I going to pick up my interest each year? What's the money that they're going to give me back worth? How is their economy doing? Are they keeping a handle on inflation? What do I think is going to happen to interest rates in that country in the future? Because if I think the interest rates are going to go up in the country that country in the future, then maybe it's not worth me lending them money and taking my return now. Maybe it's worth me waiting a while, because if I lend them some money in the future, they're going to have to pay me more. Are interest rates going to go down? If I think they're going to go down, then actually maybe I'll snap up these bonds now, because I think that if I wait 6 months, I'm not going to get as good a return. Then you take your country out of isolation and you start looking at the fact that I have a choice as an investor. Do I buy UK bonds? Do I buy US bonds? Do I buy German bonds? Do I buy, bonds from anywhere around the world? So you start going, okay, well, which country is it best to put my money into? Which country do I think is going to perform better on those metrics that we were just talking about than this other country here? Country A, is that going to be better than country B? Then you need to look at, what do I think is going to happen to interest rates around the world? Do I think they're going to go up? Do I think they're going to go down? If I think they're going to go down, then I want to buy these bonds now. If I think they're going to go up, then I might wait. Or if I think they're going to go down by less than expected, maybe I want a bit more money to lend to this country. And in fact, maybe I want a bit more money to lend to any of these countries, which is what is going on at the moment. Is not entirely down to Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer's management of the economy, in the exact same way that what happened after the Liz Truss mini budget was not entirely down to Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng's ill-fated mini budget. However, they definitely had a major part to play, and so does the Chancellor at the moment, which is, imagine what we're going to talk about in a minute.
Okay, is this as bad then? Because this is the, the yields are higher than they were at Truss, higher than the financial crisis. It sounds absolutely terrible. It seems to my mind the Truss Kwasi Kwarteng mini budget, nobody really knew what was happening. And then it was like, pow, everyone went crazy. Whereas this seems to be, since we've had the budget in October, we've seen this coming. They've been going up. Is it the
Yeah,
same thing?
that is fair. What is similar in both cases is that there has been a bit of a misjudgment on the part of the people who have delivered the budget, stroke the mini budget. There wasn't even really officially a mini budget. They definitely made a much bigger misjudgment, just to be absolutely clear here. Okay. But it was within a scenario where interest rate expectations were changing all around the world, in the UK, in the US, in Europe, in major economies. Okay. Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng were caught out by that as well. Rachel Reeves has been caught out by that as well. The expectation now in the UK and in the US is that interest rates are not going to go down by as much as was previously thought, and that inflation is going to remain stickier. Go back to then, the expectation was that interest rates were going to go ha have to go up by more than was thought. But the same thing is happening. There's heightened interest rate expectations rather than lower. This has been much more of a slow burn. The Liz Truss Kwasi Kwarteng thing was much more sudden, and it was a bigger jump. You have to go, like, what is the percentage, proportional jump going on here? And the proportional jump for Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng was bigger. That was also influenced by this stuff going on in the pension world, where there was some overly complex, too smart for their own good pension investments going on, this whole LDI thing that happened. And you ended up with a bit of a kind of doom loop, which is why the Bank of England had to step in. It didn't have to step in only because of Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng. You then have to look at the fact that actually some of the stuff that came after that has probably caused us a bit of the problem that we're in now, because after Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng left office, we got the fun police in the form of Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak. And Jeremy Hunt didn't just reverse the tax cuts, which the problem with those was they were unfunded, they didn't come with OBR costings, and they were all done all of a sudden in one go. And I mean, why they decided, for example, to overshadow their income tax cut for everyone with an income tax cut for the highest earners, I will never know, right? But Jeremy Hunt came in, he didn't just reverse the tax cuts, he actually hiked taxes, which we're now paying the price for now because probably growth would have been better. Now, what's gone on with Rachel Reeves is, firstly, I would say this problem started when the £22 billion black hole press conference happened. Up until the £22 billion black hole press conference, nobody had any issue whatsoever with the UK economy or our fiscal position and didn't think that we had an economic black hole. In fact, markets were very welcoming of the arrival of the Labour government. They were broadly positive. We had a stock market bounce. UK focused companies were on the up. Gilts had done well. They were seen as a very, very competent stewards of the economy who were coming in. People welcomed the fact that the Tory government was gone after a very long time and quite a lot of chaos. And then they announced this £22 billion black hole, which was immediately disputed. It has emerged since that some of that black hole might have been pay rises that the government issued to the public sector on that very day. And there's certainly an element of truth that £22 billion black hole is not entirely true. The problem with stuff that's not entirely true or only partially true is if you say that stuff enough times, and boy, did they talk about £22 billion black holes enough times, people start to believe it. It happens with these numbers. People anchor on them and people start to go, oh, this is a problem. This is a problem. Because they were wandering around going, this is a problem. This is a terrible problem. Look at the terrible problem the Tories have left us. And all of a sudden, the mood on the UK economy changed. And people started to think, oh, maybe we're not doing so well. Then we had all of that speculation pre-budget about all of the taxes that could possibly go up. That wasn't, not the fault of the Labour Party. It wasn't the Labour Party speculating on that, but they didn't dampen it. Then we had the budget in which taxes were hiked, taxes that arguably are anti-growth. So we saw a raise in employers' national insurance contributions and a lowering of the threshold at which they're paid. At the same time as the minimum wage went up substantially, and you also got extra taxes on investment and wealth. Now, arguably, it was a bad time to do that, okay? You want to keep the recovery going. You want to get the recovery going. They were elected on a promise of growth. And also, it's a really bad time to be doing that if you've been wandering around going about £22 billion black hole, £22 billion black hole. And the reaction to it hasn't been great. The reaction has been that actually we're not going to get growth. We're going to struggle. Then we've got some growth figures showing the economy stalling. We've got inflation being more persistent than people thought. We've got a downgrading of interest rate cut expectations. And all of this has contributed to gilt yields going up, 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 up. And I must admit, it's really unfortunate if you spent a really long time going around pointing out how the Conservatives and Liz Truss crashed the economy due to gilt yields. If gilt yields under your first 6 months of economic management then surpass that level, and I wonder how long it will be before we start hearing braying Tories on the front bench shouting about the Labour mortgage penalty and throwing it back on them. To be honest, though, what I would say is with markets, prices go up, prices go down, the pendulum always swings too far one way and then it swings back. I would argue the pendulum has probably already swung too far on gilts, and actually, we are far more likely to see those yields come down. I think this is another one of those momentary panics. We've seen these momentary panics, and you have to go even bigger picture than all of the stuff that I talked about here, which is we are still in the period of readjustment from incredibly low, historically low, never seen before low interest rates for an unbelievably prolonged period, combined with mad financial stuff like quantitative easing and all those kinds of things. Then we had a pandemic. Then we had the bite back from that. We're still in that period of readjustment. So we should expect this kind of volatility.
Lee, fair. Simon's saying that he thinks that the pendulum will start swinging back. Problem is, and that's what we saw with the Liz Truss mini budget, is that there were a lot of poor people that were caught in the crossfires of that small period of time before. And let's think about mortgage rates here. They went straight up and then they started to come down. But if you were needing to get a deal in that time, you were absolutely stuffed. What have we seen with things like mortgage rates, Lee?
It was such a sharp shock after the Truss mini budget. I mean, that's the big difference. The mortgage rates really did rocket very fast, caught a lot of people out. We're at a point at the moment where mortgage rates really have settled at a kind of figure of between sort of 4 to 5.5%, depending on your circumstances, which is far higher than what we were used to before that mini budget, but were historically low. As we pointed out on this podcast before, what's happened with this kind of rising yield, gilt yields, is that SONIA swap rates, which is the sort of lender's expectations of where future interest rates are kind of going, they're quite critical in how fixed rate mortgages are priced, right? And what's happened is the SONIA swap rates have been rising over the past month. So at the start of December, 5-year swaps were at 3.8%. 2-year swaps were at 4%. As of yesterday, they were up at 4.12% for a 5-year swap and 4.26% for a 2-year swap. And actually, just earlier in the week, we had 5-year swaps jumping 0.14 percentage points in a day. It's caused a bit of a strange phenomenon in which some of the lowest fixed rate mortgages are actually currently below their equivalent swaps, which is a really rare thing. And what that suggests is that mortgage rates are probably going to start ticking higher again off the back of all this and off the back of expectations of where everything's heading. The lowest 5-year fixed rate mortgage you can currently get, and this might all be, it's a fast changing market, so this might all be gone by the time you've listened to this. 5-year fixed rate mortgage, 4.07%, lowest 2-year fixed is 4.16%. It shows you how much volatility can start to shake mortgage rates, like it did in the Truss mini budget. And we've actually had, at the tail end of last year, we did a story I thought was quite interesting. A lot of the banks, a lot of the lenders have reduced the amount of months in which you could lock in. Well, in fact, not lock in. So you would take a remortgage deal and you could change it for 6 months was typical. So you could get it in 6 months in advance. If something changed, if rates started to go down, you might be able to get a better rate and swap over to that instead. And if rates have gone up, where you could just stick with what you'd gone with, quite a lot of these lenders have sort of shaved that down to 3 months, probably because of the volatility. So mortgage rates probably going to start ticking higher, probably going to see a bit of that next week. It just depends how much gilt yield mania sort of simmers down. If things could settle down by next week, they could also turn into complete madness. But I'm opting for the first one of that list.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so. I guess, Simon, before we move on from this, the question now is, if borrowing costs have gone up, where does that leave Rachel Reeves with her sort of fiscal headroom, her self-imposed fiscal rules, as it were, the money to play with to invest? You know, we're being taxed to the hilt anyway. The budget came along. They're going up even more. It's not going to end there, is it, if this continues?
No, and Rachel Reeves left herself £9.9 billion of headroom against her revised fiscal rules in the budget. That is being rapidly eroded by the rise in borrowing costs, because if borrowing costs go up, it costs us more to service our debt, and that eats into the, you know, the headroom that she left herself. The bigger problem here is that it undermines the chances of us getting ourselves to the point where we need to be, where we do what should have been done with the change of government, the budget that should have been delivered, a blank slate fixing of the mess that our tax system is in, rather than adding extra complications. And it's worth noting that actually the budget didn't change things substantially at this point in time for the vast majority of people. People after that budget were, generally speaking, no poorer due to those tax rises and no richer. People on minimum wage, on the other hand, will have got richer thanks to the minimum wage going up. They will be slightly poorer in the future because it will impact pay rises, it might impact pension contributions, all those kinds of things in the future. But from that point on, but the perception that people have, due to just what wasn't even like any major tax rises, it was mainly just like tinkering around the edges plus the national insurance thing, the perception amongst most people is that they are poorer after that budget. And we need people to perceive that they are getting richer, not getting poorer. We also need people to feel that they're being treated fairly. The tax system is not treating people fairly. We are dragging way more people into 40% tax, which means that every time they get a pay rise, they lose more than 40% of its tax. So they don't really feel as much benefit. We're dragging more people into paying 60% tax when they lose their personal allowance above £100,000. We've got a record amount of people paying 45p tax. We've got a cottage industry, as I've talked about on this podcast before, of people trying to earn less money so that they drag themselves out of tax traps, which is totally insane. Labour shelved the, you know, the Tories' plans to sort out the child benefit thing, which is a total mess that was caused by the Tories themselves in the first place. We needed to like get rid of all that stuff and sort it out and deliver a fair tax system for people and for companies. Instead, we've made it worse. We also need to start fixing the stuff in this country that doesn't work properly. We then also need to start investing for the future. It's a shambles that we wasted all of that money on HS2 when we should have been connecting up cities in the north and so on. We need to stop making the economy to be so biased towards London and the southeast and everything like that. And we need to get growth going. But we don't have the money to do it. This means that there's even less chance of us having the money to do it and even less chance of a government being brave enough to borrow the money to do it. So we're stuck in this kind of catch-22 situation. We're basically stuck in a doom loop. So what we need to do is we need to come up with some kind of radical thinking that gets us out of it. Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng tried some radical thinking and it didn't go down that well. Maybe there was a bit too much radical thinking all in one go. What's ironic, though, and is quite amusing, is that actually for all of the criticism of Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng by Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, actually those four people pretty much bang on agree with what the UK's problem is. And that is that we need to get ourselves out of the low growth doom loop and get ourselves growing again. The Labour Party manifesto is broadly in agreement with the sentiment behind the Liz Truss Kwasi Kwarteng mini budget. They all go about these things in different ways, but the sentiment is exactly the same. So what on earth are we going to do if we don't have the money and we can't borrow the money? My suggestion would be that we go, hang on a minute, maybe we do have the money, because there's an awful lot of people in this country sitting on a lot of money in cash savings and also a lot of money in pension pots that need to be invested in retirement. And what those people want is low risk, reliable, stable returns. In fact, many of those people, for example, particularly retirement investors, and I'm talking about people actually investing in retirement, would like something like an annuity that delivers a guaranteed rate of return, you know, for the rest of their life or over a very long period, and is stable, is backed by the government, and so on. Why don't we tap up our own savers and our own pension investors for this? Why don't we go, look at this massive pool of capital that we need to unlock that could potentially unlock growth in this country? Now, arguably, you could do that just by selling them gilts, and there's nothing stopping those people from buying gilts. And if you buy a gilt and you hold it to maturity, you know exactly the return you're going to get. We could also do it through NS&I, but NS&I has to be careful about not disrupting the savings market. I think we need a new kind of hybrid thing, back Britain bonds or something like that, right? We make it easy to understand long term. So it's 10, 20, 30 years, maybe with some exit points along the way. And people put their money in, they get an interest rate return. And it's decent, probably it'll be lower than an annuity because you'll get your money back at the end. And it might even be slightly lower than a savings account or roughly level with a savings account. It'd be roughly level with what you're going to get from a gilt, for example. But the difference is that it's not in competition with the banks and the building societies and savings markets. So it's not disrupting that because it's much longer term, because fixed rate savings normally don't run for any longer than 5 years. And it's not, you know, going to sink the annuity market, because with annuities, you don't get your money back at the end, but you will get a higher rate. Why don't we just tap up our own people? If we tapped up even a small amount of that money that is sitting there, not being put to productive use in this country, then we could certainly at least get things started and get things going.
Simon for Chancellor. Just a quick one before we move on, Simon, as well. I'm off to the States for work next week. How's my pound looking?
Not as good as it did.
I've got a graph in front of me here, and I'm just looking at what it was in 2007, and it was £1 to 2.05, actually, was in October 2007.
I never look at that. Never look at that. I mean, I would argue that going to the US for leisure nowadays, for a holiday, is practically unaffordable. I would love I'd love to take my kids to Disney. I'd love to take them to Colorado to go skiing and snowboarding in Colorado. I just can't afford it.
It's
Like, I
expensive.
just, it's so expensive. I mean, it's expensive enough going to Europe. You know, their wages have gone up by more than ours. That's why it feels so expensive. And the same with America. You know, the pound has really fallen. The pound has slipped recently against the US dollar, in answer to your question, because of the problems we're having. And also because, you know, we're seen as not as good a place to put your money as the US. And also potentially the change around in US interest rate expectations is influencing that as well. It hasn't slipped by as much against the euro because interest rate expectations for the eurozone are still, they're not going to cut by as much as us.
All right, then. We will move on from this, although I'm sure it will come up again in coming weeks. But new year, new you, new role, perhaps. It is that time of year that, yes, if you aren't too busy Googling your local divorce lawyers, you might be searching the job sites instead. Apparently, January the 10th is Quitters Day. But what will give you the biggest boost to your bank account? Recruitment agency Hays has put together the top 10 jobs with the biggest pay rises of last year. So, Lee Boyce, what makes the list? I'm going to say journalism doesn't, but I'm going out on a
Right
limb
there.
there.
You'd be right there. I quit, Georgie. I quit. That's it. It's quitters day. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
What? Who comes up with this rubbish? Quitters day today. We had divorce day
PR people,
Monday.
Lee.
Yeah. Oh,
PR
it's just
people.
honestly just absolute nonsense. We've got a exclusive report here from Hays. They do it for us each year. What it looks at is 10,000 salaries they analyze. And they look at how much salaries have gone up over the year. So the average UK salary last year went up 2.4%, which is lower than the average increase of 3.5% the year before. So not the best news. But you know, it depends on your circumstances, doesn't it? You've got to go out there and go, you've got to go and hustle for that pay rise. So we've got a top 10 list here of the jobs that have seen the biggest percentage rise, salary increase. And actually, number one is a fabricator stroke welder. And most people enter these jobs by completing an apprenticeship or gaining a certification through an industry body. They have seen their pay rise typically by 9.5% to £33,500 per year. So perhaps, you know, not the best paid industry out there. But what Hayes said to us, and it's quite interesting, is, you know, it's a tough labour market out there, but the UK is grappling with a critical skills shortage. And this salary report, top 10 salary show, sort of highlights where the areas that the most talent is needed. That's why, you know, they're having to bump up wages to attract more people. And being a welder, a fabricator, you know, is a highly skilled job that you need to have a lot of apprenticeship and a lot of experience to do. So that was number one. It's quite a mixed bag of a list. So number two is a risk surveyor stroke consultant in the insurance industry. This average salary there is up 9.2%. Then we've got industrial engineer, technology cyber manager, which is one of those industries, I think, cyber, thinking about kind of like the risks and fraud and all that kind of thing about cyber attacks and whatnot. Yeah, I think that area is growing quite a lot. Site supervisor up 8%. In-house lawyer with 7 to 10 years PQE, which shows you how long it takes to learn to be a lawyer, is in at number six. Number seven, part qualified accountant, £41,375, up 7.6%. Again, in-house lawyer makes a list again at number eight with a 1 year PQE. So it's sort of early stages of being a lawyer. Then we have something called a software architect. So I think it's a kind of posh way to say someone that builds websites and makes them look good and all the front end, back end, and all that kind of stuff. £83,444 that average salary for last year, up 7.2%. And then lastly, contracts manager. In procurement, 6.8%. Now, we don't have a list of the industries in which salaries went up the least or potentially fell last year. But it's an interesting little look at what's out there. And I think it's a good way to kind of think about potentially if you were going to retrain and do something, or if you were trying to encourage your children or grandchildren potential career path. I think they're quite interesting to have a look at, you know, where are growth industries sort of happening in terms of salary. And actually, we've got some separate research in here, and it's from Total Jobs. And it says that as many as 42% of people are looking for a job or planning to find a new job this year, with 13% actively seeking a new role. Of these looking for a fresh start, data suggests that they would only consider a role with a 13% pay increase. Obviously, it depends on what your salary is, but, you know, are you worth 13% more to your employer? If you were going to go and ask for a pay rise, are you worth 13% more to your own employer? And are you kind of happy or semi-happy in your job? Because, you know, your employer, it takes a lot of effort to go out and go and replace you, potentially, costs of recruitment, costs of onboarding someone. You know, it's well worth thinking about. And get all your ducks in a row, get a good plan together, and go and ask for a pay rise. I'm always in the sort of set of, you don't ask, you don't get. And as long as you can back up everything you're saying, I don't see why there's a reason not to go for it.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Dan Beecroft of Charles Stanley for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Dan, welcome to the podcast. Happy New Year to you. The first one of these questions of 2025, and it's a pretty straightforward one. What three things could I do to sort my finances for 2025?
Well, happy New Year to you too. The beginning of the year is a good time to take stock of where you are and make sure you're on track for your goals. So with that being said, number one, review your finances. Are you ahead of where you were a year ago? What went well? What could have been better? Do you have more savings and less debt? Have you been contributing more into your pensions? How did your investments perform? I'd consider what changes occurred last year that might impact you in the future. For most people, or for a lot of people, the autumn budget threw a spanner in the works. So is now the right time to get financial professionals to help with your investments, your planning, or your tax? Two, I'd consider budgeting. Create a budget and a plan. Break down your income and your expenditure. Remember, things are costing more. Energy bills will be rising. Potentially you're on a cheap fixed rate mortgage that's due for renewal. And how's that going to impact you this year? Build an emergency fund. We usually say 3 to 6 months of essential expenditure. And pay off any bad debt, so high interest accounts, credit card debt. Three, we bang this drum all the time, but retirement planning. Have a look at your pension provisions. How much do you have? What are you saving each month? You can use retirement calculators to see whether you are close to your target or what you'll need to contribute to improve your chances to get there. Try and maximize tax relief and employer contributions, like contribution matching. And then finally, check your state pension entitlement, particularly for those that are self-employed. Ensure that your national insurance contributions are up to date. It might be possible to pay back missed years of national insurance contributions.
Dan, three excellent pieces of advice. And I'm pretty sure that if somebody sat down at the same point in 2026 and had done all three of those things, they would probably be in a better financial position. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Private shareholders have been urged to vote on the future of seven investment trusts amid an attempted coup by a US hedge fund. Now, the Association of Investment Companies, AIC, which represents the investment trust sector, said that major changes were on the cards for those targeted firms, and it was vital that shareholders made their voices heard. Simon, before we dig into the weeds of this one, investment trusts, what are they? How do they work? Who is the AIC?
Investment trusts are a type of fund in which investors pool their money with other investors, and then it's all put together and the pot is managed by an investment manager to invest in a certain way. Except differently to investment funds, investment trusts are actually listed on the stock market. And there are some investment trusts that have very, very long histories running back over 100 years. They are a very important part of the UK's financial landscape, and they are very popular amongst investors, particularly investors who consider themselves to be in the know. Now, whether those investors are right about being in the know or not is another question. I certainly hold a lot of investment trusts in my portfolio. I think they are better for investing than investment funds because due to the way they are structured, they are listed on the stock market, so there's a limited number of shares. That means that, unlike with investment funds, where if money comes in, the investment fund then has to use that money to buy shares, to buy, you know, in the assets that it holds. And if investors want to take their money out, then that investment fund has to sell assets in order to give them the money back. Investment trusts can allow themselves to either rise to a premium or fall to a discount, the share price compared to the value of the assets that they hold. So they're not a forced seller in the same way. They can also hold over some dividends in the good years to help supplement dividends in the bad years. They have an independent board which oversees the investment manager, so there's an extra level of control. And they're just a bit less mainstream, so it's slightly contrarian, I guess. Now, what this does also leave them open to is potential takeovers, because they are listed on the stock market. And there are a number of trusts that haven't been doing so well over recent years, some of which actually have been doing pretty well over the last year, that have fallen to a discount. And a American hedge fund, Saba, has come forward and staged a pretty audacious attempt to take over 7 of them. So not just one investment trust or two investment trusts. Saba wants to take over 7 investment trusts. Basically, the message is, sack your board, put us in charge, we'll sack the managers, we'll take over. They haven't actually said we'll sack the managers and we'll take over the management, but you could take that as read that that's what they're going to do. Now, what they're going to do with these investment trusts if they get control of them, nobody quite knows. Some people are like, they're going to try and merge them. But to try and merge 7 investment trusts that all have very different, you know, investment mandates, which is, you know, the investment trust is meant to be doing a certain thing and the shareholders buy into it based on the fact that it's doing a certain thing. And to change its mandate, you have to put it to a vote and so on. The board oversees it and stuff would be quite difficult.
Mm.
Are they just going to try and rely on investor inertia and whack up the fees, for example? Or is it just an asset grab? Do they just want the assets? Do they just want the assets slightly cheaper than they could buy them on the open market because these investment trusts are trading at a discount? Nobody's quite sure. But there has been a fight back amongst the investment trust world. So the boards of these investment trusts have largely said, you need to vote against Saba because they are not acting in your best interest. We act in your best interest. They are acting in Saba's best interest. Saba has said, on the other hand, we are major shareholders in all these trusts. We think the boards are running them badly. We think some of these managers aren't doing a good job. And we have decided that we want to take control because we're going to improve things for us and for other investors. The investment managers who run the trusts, they can't really say, you know, vote against Saba. But what they can say is, you need to make sure that you have your say. And this is where the problem comes in, is that basically, as with many company votes nowadays, you know, your normal companies, particularly with investment trusts, they get very, very low turnout in these votes. People just don't bother to vote. Investors don't even notice. And it's got even worse due to the fact that many people hold their investments through investment platforms nowadays. So there's a detachment compared to when they were direct shareholders and they get letters sent straight to them from the company. But what the message is to investors, and if you hold any of these 7 investment trusts, I will list them now. Herald Investment Trust, Baillie Gifford US Growth, Edinburgh Worldwide, European Smaller Companies, Keystone Positive Change, CQS Natural Resources, or Henderson Opportunities Trust. You must pay attention to that email that you've got from them, or that letter that you get from them, or actually actively go out and find this information yourself. Find out how you vote and cast your vote. Have your say. Whether you vote for Saba or against Saba, which is what I think most of the boards and the investment managers are hoping people will do, whichever way you vote, just make sure you have your vote, right? Because this is your money. This is your money that a US hedge fund is trying to grab control of in a hostile fashion. And you have the right to have your say on whether that should happen. So do bother to have it. Don't just let it happen and then moan about it after the event. Okay.
Yeah.
This is really, really, really important. And I say this as somebody who actually does have a shareholding in two of these investment trusts. I have a shareholding in Keystone Positive Change and Henderson Opportunities Trust, and I haven't voted yet. Okay. So the thing I should do when I finish this podcast is I should go open my emails, follow the links through, and have my say.
It's quite hard to vote, isn't it? Because we don't really know that much about Saba Capital's go hard or go home proposals, do we?
Well, they've you know, it doesn't take long to find the information about what they've said so far. But maybe you think if somebody is doing this and they've not given you all the information you need, then you should vote against it. But I would say, you know, like, vote on the information that you have, but just make sure that you vote. And we've had loads of stories on this, particularly this week. We've had loads of stories on it. We could do loads of more on it. So just come to This Is Money, find the articles. And if you want to find out definitely where they are, thisismoney.co.uk/investing.
All right, then. Lee, Dave Fishwick, good friend of This Is Money and of Lee, and he of Bank of Dave and Netflix fame, has another movie out. Lee, you caught up with him. Tell us a little bit more.
I did, yeah. So Dave and I relationship goes back quite a long way, and with This Is Money. In fact, I was looking through the archives the other day and I thought, wow, I was in my sort of early to mid-20s when I first met Dave. It was like a very, very long time ago. And actually, at the time when I met him, he was doing a whole kind of thing around payday lenders. And we remember the names of Wonga and some of those others that were charging sky-high APR. And he did a kind of documentary around that as he tried to sort of battle to kind of stop that kind of behavior. You know, people that were getting into spiraling debt were contacting him left, right, and center. Dave, being a good natured and kind hearted person, wanted to try and help people, especially in his local area, who were falling into these kind of debt traps. And that was a kind of other thing he was doing while also trying to set up a bank. So Netflix made a kind of biopic of his life, which came out at the end of 2023, which was largely, as he says, a true-ish story. So that's what the focus of the first film was. And it was such a runaway success that they made a second one. And it's all about him taking on the payday lenders. Now, I love this because I think, wow, this is going global. You know, this film is going global. And it's quite funny to think of audiences around the world kind of finding out about the payday loan industry and the kind of misery that they cause.
How bad was it, Lee? Because we talked about it for loads a few years ago. And of course, it all sort of, with Wonga going under, it just sort of feels like we don't really ever talk about it. Is it completely gone?
It hasn't completely gone. It's not as visible, I think, as it once was, because there was quite a lot of advertising budget around. And there was a big crackdown. It's just taken a different form. It's just not as mainstream. And there was a lot more checks and things that needed to be done. That was a kind of argument around this sort of soft checks. And how people, vulnerable people, were getting, you know, loans for £1,000, £2,000, £3,000 and not fully understanding the consequences of doing that with APR that could be up to sort of 5,000%. So this new film is, that's the backdrop, as Dave, now our hero Dave, now takes on payday lenders rather than the big banking boys. And I caught up with him this week to find out more.
All right, well, let's take a listen, shall we, Lee?
The first film was all about you starting up your bank, Burnley Savings and Loans. The next film, the next step along with this with Netflix, is all about the payday lenders and how you took them on. So tell us a little rundown of what the story is of Bank of Dave 2.
So Bank of Dave 2 is when myself and David Henshaw, my right-hand man, who's been with me right from the beginning, we made a documentary a few years ago about looking into the payday loan industry. And that was called The Loan Ranger. We looked at why the payday lenders were taking and charging so much money. People were writing to us at Burnley Savings and Loans and saying, you know, we've been charged this, we've been charged that. I've been going on the radio chatting about things and people were ringing up on the radio to say, there's a big problem with payday loans. So I thought, well, we need to go look at that. So we ended up having a really good look at Wonga, and Wonga were charging 5,000% APR, Lee. And the problem is, whatever you do, you're never, ever, ever going to catch that up. And then there's fees that go on top. So I thought to myself, right, okay, these people that's written to me, let's see if we can have a look at that specifically and see if we can pay the payday lenders back. So I went looking for the payday loan companies. And when I got there, there were cupboards in London with a number on the front and a PO box, and that's it. Nobody were actually there. These payday loan companies all originate from America, or 99% of them. And that was the huge problem. Now, when I made the original payday loan series, I helped get Wonga shut down, which was one of the worst, and things got a little bit better. But then there's more and more opened up. And what you'll find is most of these payday loan companies have the bosses in America, or the head offices in America, where they do really exist. And that's what this movie's all about, really, is about when I went looking for the payday loan companies, they're all from America, and they in the UK, they're just PO boxes or cupboards. And, you know, I end up on the roof of Wonga in real life, and we end up fighting with the payday loan services because they try and throw me out of buildings because I'm trying to pay them the money back, Lee, for these ladies and gents that have got really stuck in spirals of debt. I've offered to pay them the full loan back plus interest, and they just didn't want to take it because they never actually want you to pay them back. They want to put you in more and more debt.
Those really sky-high APRs. I mean, we were no strangers to taking the fight to Wonga. They were everywhere, weren't they? The TV advertisements, the advertising all over football, wherever it was, it seemed like you couldn't move for Wonga and the payday lenders. So the original documentary for that, it was award-winning, wasn't it? It won a few awards, and it's going to be...
We won a Royal Tavern Society Award, yeah.
And that's being remastered and it's going to be on Netflix next week, is that right?
Next Wednesday. So the original documentary comes out remastered and reinvented and lots of things added, and some of the music took out because I think some of the artists didn't like me murdering their songs so badly with my karaoke and wanted such a lot of money for it to go global, that it's sometimes a little bit easier to take a little bit of the music out. So we put some more in. And we added some other things, and it's really cool. And it's going to be nice to see the new version of it. But it's always nice to see the documentary series as well as the movie, because the first movie, The Bank of Dave 1, is Netflix's most successful British independent film of all time. It then set off around the world, and it were number one in Australia, New Zealand, loads of places in Europe. It were top 10 in pretty much everywhere else.
I also, just before we came to record this bit, I was looking back of when I first met you. It was 11 years ago. I came up to Burnley and we were talking about Burnley Savings and Loans and how you were lending money to businesses that had been turned down and all of that kind of thing. And it was just an incredible story. And I was wondering, with the first film and the second film, I know you were quite heavily involved in the first film in terms of they shot your house. It was actually your house that was used in the film. Is it the same for the second one? And how much were you involved in, you know, for example, choosing locations? Because isn't it true to say that the local pub is actually the local pub that you used to go to when you were a young labourer? Or am I making that up?
No, you're spot on. I mean, with the first one, I had some control over it, which was really good, with the Bank of Dave 1. With Bank of Dave 2, I have even more control. And one of the things about Bank of Dave 2 is before I signed the contract for it, I said to them, the pub has to be the one in Burnley. Because in the first one, the pub is one in Leeds for ease of access. But this time I said, no, it has to be the one in Burnley. It's called the Talbot. And it's the pub next to Burnley College. When I was a youngster, I left school absolutely useless, as you know. I had no skills whatsoever. And I ended up as a builder's labourer with a one-day-a-week course at Burnley College for bricklaying. So at lunchtime, we'd go down to the pub for a pint, and I'd go in the Talbot, which were next door to the college. And we used to have a jukebox there, and I'd listen to Def Leppard songs. It was really, really interesting that Netflix said, yes, that's no problem. So they took the pub over. Probably shouldn't tell you this, but just keep this between you, me, and your listeners. Def Leppard actually flew over specially to play a concert in that pub for real, which we did, and you'll see in the movie. Right. If you look in the right-hand corner of the pub when you're watching them sing, you'll see a lady with a blonde hair, which is Nikki, Mrs. F, with a blonde wig and very heavily disguised. And next to that person, you'll see a man, me, in a completely different outfit, looking like a mod, and with a wig on, next to the lady with blonde hair singing. That's a sneaky preview, but don't tell anybody. I'll be well in trouble just for saying it.
Now, I'm not going to ask you if there's going to be a Bank of Day 3, because I imagine you're in that position at the moment with plugging Bank of Two Dave has probably been quite a full-time experience, as well as running a business, as well as everything else that you do with your life. So I'm not going to ask about number three, but what I'd like to ask is that you obviously for a long time wrote some columns for us as our kind of business doctor, and we kind of haven't been doing it for a little while just because you know how busy you've been with the filming and all of that kind of thing. But it's a bit of doom and gloom around at the moment, Dave, and you are, I would possibly put you definitely top three, but probably top one most positive person that I've ever met in my life. You are just positive and about everything. So I was wondering if you could end this on a nice little positive note. And if you were thinking about starting a business in 2025, or if you were thinking about investing for the first time or getting your finances all in order, all that kind of thing, what advice would you give, Dave? What's the kind of like one nice little nugget, nice gem of advice from, you know, one of the most successful Northern entrepreneurs of the last sort of 50 years?
Yeah, that's very kind of you to say. And I love being the business doctor and the Mail Online. And as soon as the movie's out the way, we can ask for some more questions. I love being part of it. You've been part of the story right from the beginning, Lee, and you've been very helpful. And you've known such a lot of the secrets before we've launched it. And you're brilliant at keeping a secret. And Bank of Day 3, there's a real possibility. I think that it's difficult to talk about just yet because we're doing number two. And we're so excited that the musical, as you know, the Bank of Day musical, that's that the 65 people working on that currently. I'll give another update on that in the coming weeks. And the businesses that I run, the biggest of which is in America, it's an investment company in America. And I just think that that business in America, it started with a small amount of money, Lee, and it compounds at 21% a year. And it has done for about 17 or 18 years now. And I'm self-taught. And I think if a lad from Burnley with no qualifications leaves school, builds his labourer, sets off building the first new high street bank for 150 years in Britain, builds six different independent businesses of each other, one of which is at the other side of the world, compounding at 21%, teaches himself how to invest and to buy and sell solid, decent, honest, ethical stocks and shares and invest in businesses over in America. If I can do it, then anybody can. You do not have to be a brain surgeon or gone to Oxford or Cambridge to make things happen. You've just got to have self-belief, decency, honesty. Yeah, you've got to have common sense, and you've got to believe in yourself. That's just a big, big thing, because if you start believing in yourself, then other people will too. This year is going to be really, really good for an awful lot of people. They think, you know, the worst of the pandemic and all the other things is behind us now, and I want to see this year being the best. So if people are watching the movie and they've watched it and they've felt good about things at the end of it, I want people, some people will cry, some people will smile, some people will be happy. I want them to walk out and think, right, tomorrow, if Dave can make it happen, then tomorrow I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to apply for that new job. I'm going to go for that pay rise. I'm going to start that small business. I'm going to do that thing that I've been waiting over the last few years, because it's been a tough time for a lot of people the last few years. But the minute you've watched it, then you want to go outside, one step in front of the other, and let's just make it happen. Have the courage to follow your dreams.
Listen, you should go and check out the film, open up a nice bottle of red or maybe a pint of bitter, fish and chips, and get it on, or get it on this weekend. Bank of Day 2, The Lone Ranger, is out now. Dave, best of luck with it, and thanks for coming onto the podcast.
Real pleasure, Lee. Always a real pleasure. And thank you for all your support over the last years and years and years. It feels like we've known each other forever. Thank you so much. Love to everybody listening.
Right, that was Lee chatting to Dave Fishwick. The movie, the second movie, is out now, so do take a watch of that. Let us know what you think. But it is a podcast reader question time. The winner of this week's This Is Money mug is David from Liverpool. Happy New Year to Simon, Georgie and Lee and the team. Love the podcast and how accessible and friendly it is. Thank you. I swear, Simon, we only do this just so we can make ourselves feel better, blow wind up our... Anyway, I'm in the fortunate position, says David, in my early 30s, my God, to have paid off my mortgage and my student loan. I put a sizable amount each month into my ISA, max out my lifetime allowance, ISA allowance each year of £4,000, and have a small portion put away into premium bonds. Goodness, David, you are doing well. My question, though, is about credit cards. Growing up, I was always told only to save up and buy what I can afford and have therefore never had a credit card. I never had a problem with being approved for mortgage or phone contracts and have never felt the need to use one. Recently, however, friends have recommended various cashback or reward credit cards that they say would enable me to feel some benefit from what I pay out, with cashback options and perks, etc. I understand there is an option to set up direct debits each month so that I would never have to worry about paying the total off each month, and this is something I would definitely use to my advantage. My question, therefore, is, if I am strict and religious about paying my balance off each month, do the benefits of a credit card outweigh the potential negatives? How important is a credit rating if I've already paid off my mortgage and have no current intentions of moving again? Thanks again for all the time and hard work you put into the podcast. It really is a great listen. Kind regards, David from Liverpool. Just firstly, I suppose, within this, Simon, the link between credit cards and credit ratings?
Yes. And one of these days, we're going to do one of these questions without reading out all the nice stuff that people say to us at the start.
No, Simon, never.
But,
never.
That's not yet. So keep saying that stuff in your emails to us, please. That's fantastic. Yeah. Love to hear it. Just keep sending it in. Having a credit rating, a good credit rating, is important. You might not think that you need to borrow money now, but things change. You might want to borrow money in the future. You might want to move. You might want to buy a car on finance. You might want to do something else. So having a credit rating is important. A good way to have a good credit rating is to show that you have borrowed some money and then you've paid it back. There are different ways that you can build this up. You know, even things like energy bill direct debits can count towards this and stuff like that. A credit card is a simple way of doing it. You basically just, you know, keep it operating. You don't have to be spending loads on a credit card and every month and then paying it back and so on. I very rarely use a credit card, for example. I do have a mortgage, though, but I very rarely use a credit card. My credit rating is fine, and that's always been the case. Now, what I would say, going back to the question, is you've hit the nail on the head, unsurprisingly, for someone who's managed to get themselves into such a good position in their 30s, is that reward credit cards, whether it's to earn points or cash back or anything, are great if you are absolutely militant about paying your bill in full every single time. Not just paying the minimum, right? But paying your bill in full. Because the way to make the most of these things is to do all of your spending on them and rack up the points. And then you can use those points, for example, if it's Avios, to buy flights, or if it's cashback, you can rack up the cashback. The cashback might be limited to a certain amount. So once you go beyond a certain point, it may not be worth you doing any more spending. But for the people who do this, it can be a nice little earner. But for every single person for whom it is a nice little earner, there are more people for whom it is not a nice little earner, because they don't pay their bill off in full each time. And that means they get charged interest at credit card rates, which is very, very high. And that will outweigh possibly any benefit that they personally get from having the card. And in aggregate, massively outweighs any costs that the credit card company faces from paying out rewards and benefits to people, which is why credit card companies offer reward cards, because they know that the vast majority of people who take them out will slip up somewhere and it'll end up being profitable for the credit card company rather than for the person who takes them out. And as an example on this, I will give you two people. I will give you my sister-in-law and brother-in-law. So that's actually, two people there. Okay. Now they do, I'll give you three people because I'm going to give you another one after that. Right. They do loads of their household spending on cards that mean that they are picking up Avios points, okay? And then they pay it off in full at the end of the month, stick all the, like, the grocery shopping and all that kind of stuff on it. Now, my sister-in-law texted me the other day, and she told me that she just got herself and her husband some flights to Corsica, return for a weekend away, £2.
Oh, nice.
Boom. I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it? That's basically you're getting free travel for a weekend away off the back of spending that you were going to do anyway. Now, I'll give you what was originally going to be my second person, but it's actually my third person here. Me. I am the not so proud owner of a credit card, of an Amex card that gives me Avios points. I don't know how long I've been spending on this Avios card for, on this Amex card, right? I don't spend on it that often, but I don't know how long it's been for. I don't want to know how long it's been for. I'm guessing, I want to say probably 5 years, but I'm sort of, I keep doing this and then I realize that 5 years only takes me back to like 2019. And I'm like, oh yeah, it wasn't that long ago, pandemic, etc. Probably 8 years, probably longer. I've never had a free flight ever. Literally never had a free flight ever. And fortunately, I don't do all of my spending on it because I'm the kind of mug who forgets to pay his bill. I always pay the minimum payment because that's set up by direct debit. I'm the kind of mug who forgets to pay his bill and I end up paying some interest. It's never that much. It's like 20 quid, 30 quid. All those 20 quids and 30 quids over the years will have racked up to a substantial amount and would vastly outweigh the benefit of any free flights I'd got from it if I'd ever actually managed to book any free flights. As it stands, I've never booked a free flight in my life, so I'm just losing. In fact, the last time I tried to do it, I realised that I could only get myself a flight, not my wife. Then if I wanted to get my wife a flight as well, it would mean that obviously we'd have to fly BA, which was going to be more expensive than just flying a combination of EasyJet and Swiss anyway. So I binned off the opportunity to get my free flight. And yet again, I haven't got a free flight. And do you know what I did? I stuck some stuff on it, including those flights that I bought before Christmas. I didn't pay my bill off in full at the end of the month, and now I owe them another £10 in interest. Well done, Lambert.
Oh, Simon, I'm similar to you. I got an Amex card at the start of last year, I think, or maybe longer, I don't know, whatever. I've got about 170,000 Avios points now. I have no idea. I've not even looked at how I'd spend them. I just keep thinking, oh, I've got lots of Avios points. And you have to pay for the card every year. So I'm wondering, like, at what point am I going to stop? I think it's about 200 quid a year or something. I think, for what? Am I going to end up using these, or are they just going to keep racking up for no benefit at all? I don't know. Like, I know that there's going to be loads of people out there who absolutely love Avios and they know how to play the system and da-da-da. To me, it just feels like a big faff.
A safer bet would be the cashback thing, because at least you know you're going to get that, right?
Yeah.
But then you still got to pay your bill off in full every time. And because if you don't do that, you can easily outweigh the cashback.
Oh, yeah, I have it set up that I pay off my bill. I've never been charged interest on it, etc. So I'm only paying the fee. What I would say to David, though, in this situation, and you completely covered this, is David seems to be a very, very financially savvy, smart, astute, you know, diligent person that I don't think would get into trouble in this way. It's a question of know yourself. If you're someone that's going to be caught into that trap, you're only going to be spending just to get that those points, etc. It's a bit like using cashback sites. It's only really great if you're using it for spending that you would do anyway. So I would say, for someone like David, and we're not advising him to do anything here, but you know, as long as you're sensible and you set up and you pay it off, then absolutely fine. But if you're someone that knows that this is going to get you in trouble, don't do it. Right, Simon, stat of the week.
Okay, my stat of the week is a very simple one. I recently applied for a new passport. How long did it take me to get my new passport? From the point of application to it arriving through my door.
I reckon you're going to be impressed by this. I reckon it took 6 days.
Lower.
Wow.
I applied for a new passport. I've got the email. It's got the time on it. At 2:52 p.m. on Tuesday this week, that passport came through my door just before 11 o'clock this morning. I got a new passport, and this wasn't fast track. This was just the normal passport application process, in 2 days and 20 hours.
Wow.
I absolutely take my hat off to the passport application people, okay, and how they have turned it around from the chaos
that
they were in. And I'm not alone. I've seen loads of reports of this recently from people saying how what astonishingly good a service. And it's a really good service. There's constant updates. There's reminders and everything like that. They text you, they email you, they keep you updated. The other thing I did is I had to get a new driving license, and I applied just before Christmas, and it arrived just after Christmas, and Christmas was in the middle of that. And so the DVLA was also in absolute chaos in terms of driving license applications. And they've turned that one around as well. And I hope that there is other stuff, you know, in government departments who are looking at the passport
hope for Britain yet.
And how they've turned that around and trying to put it in place in other places. I absolutely take my hat off to them.
A nice positive story to end the podcast, which started rather miserably about the state of Britain. But yes, maybe it is the great turnaround starts at the passport office. Right, that is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, if you want to win a mug or anything else you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Send us your question with question in the subject line and you will be in line for question of the week and a This Is Money mug. All the people who've had your questions read out, we have the mugs. Now it's the new year. We are going to start sending them out. I promise you, you will get your mugs.
We're not
soon.
Like the passport office.
No, we're not as good as the passport office. Maybe they need to come in and sort us out. But we will get those mugs to you. But anybody who's got any good questions, please send them to us. We'll pick out the best one and do it each week. You can also share any thoughts that you have on the podcast or anything else we've talked about. podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can do the social media thing on the platform formerly known as something else, now known as something else, that is increasingly just becoming the mouthpiece for someone
else.
May potentially be becoming increasingly deranged at This Is Money. Or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and find all podcast paths and join in the debate and reader comments, which is by far and away the best way to talk about the stuff that we're talking about here.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.